This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Did a comet strike the Earth 12,800 years ago, causing global wildfires and starting an age of cooling? Scientists are still arguing whether that happened. In this show, we start with Dr. Joanne Ballard, a co-author of two new papers with evidence that it did happen. I'll follow with comet expert Mark Boslow. He says the science behind this hypothesis is flawed. Then I'll close with my own impressions of the science, the believers, and why all this matters a lot for our future. After all, the next comet strike can come at any time. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's go. In the second week of February 2018, two unexpected comets passed by the Earth, and they came closer than the Moon. The mystery is, why have we not been hit by a large rock from space during the human times, at least as much as we can remember? A group of scientists say there was a strike around 12,000 years ago. They claim it darkened Earth with fires on multiple continents, wiping out large animals, and kicking off a cooling period known as the Younger Dryas. Around 2006, a couple of books were published on this comet strike, with lots of media coverage. There was also pushback from other scientists, claiming it never happened or there wasn't enough evidence. Two new papers have been published in the Journal of Geology. The lead author in both is Wendy S. Wolbach, along with 26 other scientists. To make the case for a climate-changing extinction-level comet strike just a few thousand years before the discovery of agriculture and the rise of civilization, here is co-author Joanne P. Ballard. Dr. Ballard is an archaeologist for the Tennessee Valley Authority in Knoxville. Joanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, too. You know, there's so much to this story, but why don't we start with this? Talk to us about the trail of extraordinary fires found by your group happening around 12,800 years ago. How big were they, and how do we know that they happened?
Okay, well, this paper initially was a response to the 2009 Jennifer Marlin paper that came out where she synthesized 35 charcoal records across North America. But she did not have very many records across the Midwest. And their results were, we don't really see a peak for the onset of the Younger Dryas. So since then, I have developed several charcoal records, actually from Four Lakes in Michigan. And so that's been added. And Jacqueline Gill and Katie Leininger also contributed charcoal data sets from Indiana and Ohio. And so those have helped fill in a gap where we didn't have any data. And so in this paper by Wolbach and others, there's 152 charcoal records. So we've got a larger data set. And this time, when we run the statistics on it, it does show a peak at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
And some of those fires, though, were they in Africa or Europe or other places besides North America?
I think that we used in this paper data sets from North America.
Okay.
I think the focus is on North America. And then to support that, because that's just, you know, one aspect, you're just looking at charcoal, and it's an imperfect proxy. So we need other lines of evidence, and one of these would be the Greenland ice cores, the gold standard for paleoenvironments. So we look at chemical markers in those to support combustion, and there's certain chemicals in there such as formate, oxalate, ammonium, that give an indication of broad-scale combustion, biomass burning. And so we do see peaks in those chemicals for the onset of the Younger Dryas. That helps support the idea that, you know, there was a widespread wildfire event at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
And just to get an idea of your work, you personally presented a conference paper in 2014 on the late glacial fires in Alabama and Michigan. What did you find?
So that was presented at the Southeastern Archaeological Conference in Greenville, South Carolina. And the sites were Cahaba Pond, Alabama, which had been worked on before by Hazel Delcourt. She, in fact, collected the cores and did pollen analysis on the cores. And so that gives us insight into the vegetation that was growing in the lake basin. And so if you core different lakes over a larger region, you get a pretty good picture of what was growing there 14,000 years ago, 13,000 years ago, and so on into the Holocene. So the Cahaba pond record started at 14,000 years ago, and beech was the dominant species, along with a lesser species that was there at the pond was hop hornbeam. And both of those species are fire intolerant. So we would not expect to see lots of fires if these trees are thriving. So they're coming along doing well. And then in the younger dryas, there's a drastic change. The beech and hop hornbeam go away, and oak and southern pines become the dominant species there. And you can see in the core itself, there's some kind of dramatic change from mineral-rich to organic-rich sediment in the pond. So this was a very intriguing core to work on. So then I wanted to do the charcoal analysis, and is there any other proxy I can use to look for something unusual across the Younger Dryas boundary, across the Lake Glacial? So together with Stephen Dreese, who is a soil scientist at Baylor, he was on my committee at the University of Tennessee, we used thin sections. So these are paper-thin slices of epoxied mud, and this technique is usually applied to soils, but we decided we wanted to try it on lake sediments. What microstructures can we see? And we got a very intriguing result, and that is there were these structures in there that are siliceous aggregates. And the initial question was, well, where did they come from and what does this mean? So it turns out that they form from wood ash. So wood ash is another byproduct of fire. And the wood ash, there's little silica structures in the twigs, bark, and leaves of trees. And when they burn, those phytoliths are in the ash. And in that highly alkaline environment, as you get water percolating through the ash, that silica turns to a gel. And if there is silt, which would be dust, another word for silt is dust, the silica gel sticks to the silt substrate and hardens up, and this is remaining evidence of a wildfire. So the interesting thing about finding those siliceous aggregates at Cahaba Pond is, you know, there are actually six sites that we looked at. Five of them had siliceous aggregates during the Lake Glacial. So we also looked in Anderson Pond at other periods of time in the core, because we don't want to, like, say that they're specific to the Lake Glacial if it's a common thing. But actually, we did not find any in Holocene sediments. So this, to me, looks like another potential marker for some event. But we need to do more work on this because it is a promising new proxy for wildfire that would supplement charcoal data, soot, and soot data, and so on.
Boy, we're looking for the footprints of fire more than 12,000 years ago and finding them. That's kind of exciting stuff. I have to say, one of my listeners, who is a geologist who also tracks hits from outer space, he suggests these fires could have natural causes. And he's talking about a peak temperature that generally ends the warmer states known as stadials just before cooling time, like the Younger Dryas. Could the fires that you've discovered and discussed in your paper have been simply due to climate change rather than a comet strike?
Okay, Alex, this is an excellent question and one I've asked myself. So how do we differentiate? Because we have forest fires today. Some of them are fairly large. You know, it's a common thing in the boreal forests of Canada to have forest fires. So how do we differentiate that we've got a catastrophic wildfire situation? So this is where a multi-proxy approach has to be used. So you look for something else that distinguishes those fires from other wildfires. So in the biomass burning paper, in addition to the charcoal, we looked at soot. We supplemented with the platinum peak, although that's more of an extraterrestrial signature, but also the chemical markers for biomass burning in the ice cores. And those are ammonium formate, oxalate, and levoglucosan would be a good marker to analyze for, but that's only been done for the historical part of the Greenland ice cores.
On Radio EcoShock, scientists like Alan Robach explained nuclear winter that would follow a nuclear exchange, and other scientists have told us about a darkening that lasted for several years after an asteroid strike hit around the Gulf of Mexico 66 million years ago. What evidence does your group present to suggest there was an impact winter around 12,800 years ago?
Well, I talked to Wendy Walbeck about this because she's the soot expert, and she said we estimate YDB being the Younger Dryas boundary, the 12,800 years ago. We estimate a YDB soot footprint of 15 milligrams per square centimeters. When this amount of soot is injected into the atmosphere, the amount of time it stays aloft depends on how high it goes, a minimum of 7 days, more if it makes it into the stratosphere. So the soot's going to stay there longer if it's injected up into the stratosphere. She estimated that depending on how high up the soot went, and that it doesn't take a whole lot of soot to block out quite a bit of sunlight, she estimated darkness for months to a year. And she's comparing to the Cretaceous Paleogene event. That's where they estimated months to a year. And so I would say not over a year for the Younger Dryas event.
So the key to the whole Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, as it's known, is a hit by an object from outer space. What does your group think happened?
I consulted with Bill Napier on this, the astronomer in our group. And he says that we consider a swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide are much more likely to have occurred than maybe a large asteroid or something like that, and can account very well for the wildfires in Walbach et al. 2018. Such impacts would not usually leave craters, although we could certainly not rule out one or two larger objects as part of the mix.
So this was something that broke up in the air and then hit in multiple places at more or less the same time.
It could have, because there are also fires in Europe, and I have studied, they're called the Ousel Horizon, and it's a burn-rich layer that dates to approximately the beginning of the Younger Dryas that is in the cover sands there. And so I've studied four different sites over there. And those include, they're charcoal-rich, there's algae, there's sponge spicules, there's fused quartz, and there's melt glass in those layers. So that's suggesting a thermal pulse. So, but going back to what was the nature of this, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. If the impactor or impactors struck the Laurentide ice sheet, which was 2 miles thick and covered most of Canada, most of eastern Canada, you wouldn't have a crater. There'd be a lot of meltwater, and we do, in fact, see meltwater pulse 1A at the beginning of the Younger Dryas. So that is consistent with something sudden. And the Younger Dryas is pretty well agreed that the onset was very sudden. From the ice cores and from other proxies, it was a fairly sudden thing.
There was a book in 2006 that I found. It's titled The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. Among the co-authors are two contributing authors to the new papers we're talking about in the Journal of Geology. That was Richard Firestone and Alan West. Are these two papers intended as further proof of the theory proposed in that book?
Bill Napier responded to this question because he was more familiar with that book. He said the original scenario in that book was a supernova exploded in our neighborhood 41,000 years ago and gave rise to a series of destructive shock waves as well as disturbing comets, and they were thrown in our direction. So he says this is untenable astronomically, but the ideas of the group have evolved, not randomly, but towards a pre-existing hypothesis, namely that we ran through the debris tail of a giant short-period disintegrating comet whose orbit sometimes intersects the Earth.
How would this arrival or impact drive large animals in North America into extinction?
Well, those that survived the initial blast and the wildfires and the shock waves would then be subjected to nitric acid rain, which is associated with, when you have a shock wave associated with an impact, it dissociates the nitrogen in the atmosphere, in the ozone layer, breaks up the ozone layer, you get nitrates, and they'll rain out of the atmosphere for months to maybe a year. So that would suppress regrowth or reestablishment of the vegetation in the area. So their habitat would be destroyed, So if they survive the first impact, then they have to deal with destruction of their habitat. So that's going to be pretty challenging. And so with that acid rain has been well studied for its effects, like in Appalachia and Scandinavia, since the industrial age began. It's been a problem. So we know a lot about that. And it damages the leaves on trees, it kills off aquatic organisms, fish, salamanders, and so on. So it would also suppress, like, sprouting of seeds and would probably kill off the seeds. And then it's going to take a very long time for animals and other vectors of dispersal to bring in seeds to repopulate the area with plants and trees. And the other aspect of the acid rain associated with an impact would be that it's a nutrient input. So it's nitrogen, and although it has a destructive pH, it's also a nutrient, and so you get massive algal blooms. And so for pollen diagrams and diatom diagrams at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, that's what we see. We see a lot of diatom blooms, algal blooms, and in fact, one of the characteristic features that we see in sediments for the beginning of the Younger Dryas is these so-called black mats that have been studied by Vance Haynes and others, Jay Quaid. So these are algal-rich layers that have like these carbon spherules and magnetite grains. So why do we suddenly have all these algal overgrowth at that time? So that would be my hypothesis for that. And we should be studying a lot more nitrogen records, nitrogen isotopes, try and see if there's a common link there.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Has Earth really escaped a large strike from outer space during our human time? From Tennessee, we are talking with Dr. Joanne Ballard about two new papers that say a big hit changed the Earth relatively recently. Joanne, the NASA Center for Near-Earth Object Studies says no large impacts have occurred in the last 15,000 years. Your group disputes that?
Yes, and Bill Napier has answered this question. He said you might be thinking that the YDB was triggered by an object from outer space, but instead, you know, instead of the initial Firestone idea of a 4-kilometer-wide comet, he considers large impacts are red herring and proposes, as we said before, the swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide. And in my view, we might not be able to recognize all the impacts on Earth because a lot of them are unrecognized. We're a watery planet, and some of those impacts, if they go into the ocean, if they're not as large, I guess, we won't see them. If there's impacts in a forest region, the vegetation will close up and cover it up, and in desert situations. So I think the number is probably higher than recognized.
Let's get to the evidence, Joanne. The two papers look into the records provided by ice cores and glaciers, which you mentioned, and lake and marine and terrestrial sediments, which is more your specialty. There's a wide range of very technical isotopes and rare elements being talked about in these papers and in this subject generally. I find it's a little too detailed for me to grasp. What would you present as the top one or two proofs that this kind of event happened?
Well, I would say the iridium and platinum that we found, a platinum spike in the ice core. So I'd say that's pretty significant. And also, if we can find platinum in our sedimentary record as well, that would, I think, be a very, very strong supporting evidence.
Now, as you know, some scientists have been critical of the evidence. For example, Professor Nicholas Pinter, who's with the University of California, Davis now, he wrote a requiem for this hypothesis. Others say they've performed blind tests and failed to duplicate the evidence presented. How would you answer those critics, Joanne?
Well, I'd say for the Pinter requiem paper, one thing they challenged was the carbon spherules, and they proposed that these things found in the YDB layer could easily be termite poop or fungal spores. I find that kind of ridiculous because the carbon spherules, to me, are just a combustion indicator. And so they form from combustion of forests, particularly coniferous forests. They just seemed very biased in their approach. So, and then there's also the Surville paper, where they could not, they tried to replicate and they could not find the same indicators, but they didn't use the recommended methodology. They did not separate their fractions. That means take the sediment and sieve it and sort it into fractions and then look. So I think that might explain why they had difficulty replicating the results.
What holds your group of 29 authors together? Is there an inspirational person who first expressed this theory, or who would you say are leaders in the field now?
Well, I would say the group has the common interest of wanting to contribute more to this fascinating debate. You know, the charismatic woolly mammoths, what happened to them, and all the other 34 large mammals that used to be here and are now gone. We're a very collaborative group, and I'm glad to be part of it. I would say that the inspirational person for me is probably Rick Firestone. So I learned about this hypothesis from him when I attended a paleontology conference at the Mammoth Site in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And it really was very interesting that here's this, you know, up till then, the hypotheses for why did the mammoths go extinct were overhunting by people, climate change, and hyper disease. So now here we have this new fourth hypothesis. It's very intriguing. And so after that conference, I went on to be a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. Tom Lowell was my advisor there, and studied lake sediments for charcoal, looking for this big peak at the Younger Dryas. That was what I predicted. Oh, I'll find a big peak. Well, science and nature are not that cut and dried and simple. So yes, there were peaks. In one of them, there was a definite peak at the Younger Dryas in the four lakes that we sampled. But in the others, there were peaks, but there were also additional peaks. So this is where I know that you need to have additional lines of evidence. You can't just single out one and say, oh, this peak must be the one. So you have your supporting evidence that helps you figure out what's what. But Rick Firestone has taken a lot of criticism for introducing a new idea to science, but I'm really glad he had the gumption to do it.
This seems to be a big topic for Russian researchers as well, and I suppose that's natural considering the big hit in Siberia in 1908 and the recent surprise strike in Chelyabinsk, Russia, in February 2013. The Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences hold two databases of reported hits, and they evaluate them. Has anybody in your group talked with the Russian counterparts?
Okay, I heard from Bill Napier on this one, Alex, because he's the astronomer, and so this is more along his line of study. And he said the British cometary astronomers do indeed liaise with Russian colleagues from time to time. And Bill attended a conference in Moscow in 2008 for the 100th anniversary of the Tunguska impact. However, our interest is mainly in assessing the celestial hazard from a theoretical point of view, involving cometary dynamics rather than specific impacts such as Chelyabinsk. Our connections are international, say with American or Japanese colleagues, as much as with Russians. And I would say from a paleontology point of view, I keep up with the work of Sergei Leshinsky and other Russian researchers on the mammoth side of it. There's a lot of different aspects to this hypothesis.
There is, and it's really interesting to me, Joanne, because what you're talking about is also something that could happen at any time. We just had something appear out of the sky that they only saw 5 days ahead of it arriving. So humans could experience another hit.
They could. And once again, Bill Napier says that there's a lot of effort going into detecting potential impact threats, and which I was unaware of. In 2016, NASA established an office for detecting asteroids, coordinating responses, cooperating with emergency management agencies, and the like. This is an international effort involving telescopes in Hawaii, Arizona, Japan, Australia, and other places. The aim is to discover 90% of threatening objects down to 140 meters, which would be 50 feet, yielding a 200 megaton impact, 140 meters in diameter, by the end of 2020. There's also an operational center in Frascati, Italy, under the aegis of the European Space Agency. So there's a lot going on in terms of detecting small asteroids. At the moment, discovery is very incomplete, as we see from the fact that small asteroids are discovered often as not after they have passed us, as we've seen in some recent episodes of that.
So in the end, Joanne, do you think this research that's being done is being treated fairly?
Well, whenever you roll out a new hypothesis and you challenge paradigms, you're going to get some pushback. It's kind of frustrating when people are closed-minded or they won't consider it. So I was at a conference in Los Angeles in, I think it was 2014, and there was a speaker who was talking about younger dryas impact, and he said, oh, that's been disproven. And I thought, well, no, it hasn't, because there's been several new papers on it. So I spoke up at the end of the session about that, and he wasn't very pleased. And I thought, you know, that's very biased to try and tell everybody it's no longer a viable hypothesis when there's a lot going on with it.
I'm impressed by the amount of detailed studies that are needed to present a big theory like this. Joanne, what will you research next?
Oh, I've got a long list. I'll have a paper coming out with three new charcoal records for the southeastern U.S., and this is an area where there are very few charcoal records, especially those that go back 20,000 years. I'll also have the paper on the siliceous aggregates, explaining in detail about those. And then I have a paleontological study I'm working on, which is called the Telltale Tusk, where we found a dissolved tusk. Well, one of my paleontology friends has it. It's a dissolved mammoth tusk that dates to the Younger Dryas, and I hypothesize that maybe the dissolution is from nitric acid rain. So I presented this at a Greek conference in 2014, but we need more examples of that and try and co-date them and try and get more focus on that. There, I also have samples from the Netherlands, from the Usalo burn layers, and I would like to do more work on those. And I think it would be interesting to research the muck beds in Alaska, because there are a lot of Pleistocene fossils and animals, trees. It's a very intriguing place to study late glacial dynamics, but challenging because of the nature of the sediments up there. There's solifluction, and the sediments get mixed up. So, and Malcolm Lecomte says he has unreported evidence for a major Tunguska scale event that destroyed half a dozen Middle Bronze Age cities in the Jordan River Valley. So that apparently will be a paper that's coming out.
We're starting to run out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would say if you want to learn more about this, one good source on the internet is the website The Cosmic Tusk. And so George Howard, one of the members of the group, he posts like any news about anything to do with the onset of the Younger Dryas.
I'll check it out for sure. From Knoxville, Tennessee, we've been speaking with Dr. Joanne P. Ballard. She is co-author of two new papers published in February 2018 in the Journal of Geology. The papers advance the hypothesis that a large object from outer space in some way moved by or struck the Earth about 12,800 years ago, with dire consequences for plant and animal life, plus a major change in the climate. Thank you so much for talking with us, Joanne.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, and you can find links in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Some scientists disagree with the idea that a killer comet struck the Earth 12,800 years ago. One of them is physicist and space objects expert Dr. Mark Boslow. He is a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories and adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico. Mark calls for planetary defense, but he doesn't like this hypothesis of a Younger Dryas impact. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mark Boslow, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You've been on a lot of great programs. I have seen you myself on TV, and I know you as a pioneer of the Airbuster space rocks idea that can cause significant damage, but they're not like age-ending catastrophes. Should we worry less about big asteroids and more about smaller space debris?
Well, I've argued that we should. And I should back up. I am now retired from Sandia Labs. I retired last June, and I'm sorry, I probably haven't updated everything on the web yet. But most of this work I did when I was a staff member at Sandia. I'm now at University of New Mexico.
Fair enough. And about the idea of the big asteroids, I mean, we've seen Bruce Willis on the screen trying to fight them off with nuclear weapons. But what happens when these smaller bits hit the Earth? Why should we be concerned?
Well, there's really a couple reasons why I have argued that most of the risk, at least half of the risk, is in these small ones. One is we've discovered most of the big ones that are on Earth-crossing orbits that have the potential to hit the Earth, the really big catastrophic ones. We've discovered something like 90% of those since the effort began to find them about 20 years ago. The second reason is that my models and the models of others now show that small asteroids create an airburst that's actually more damaging than an equivalent explosion from a nuclear weapon. And in the past, most of our estimate for risk came from damage from the nuclear weapons effects literature. So we've kind of updated that in the last 10 or 15 years.
So you're one of the big names in that field, and yet you're a leading critic of the Unger-Dryas impact event hypothesis. From your perspective, what are some of the problems with that idea?
Well, I guess my first problem is I don't know exactly what the hypothesis is, because each one of their papers seems to state it somewhat differently. Their original paper was the one that Firestone was the lead author of. That was in 2007. And at that point, they were pretty loose with their definition of the hypothesis. And they said, well, it was a comet or a broken comet or asteroid that either exploded in the atmosphere or in space or hit an ice sheet. And so they didn't really differentiate among these various hypotheses, and they kind of had the bases covered. And since then, it seems to have evolved quite a bit. And they don't always state it in the same terms.
Dr. Nicholas Pinter and others published a requiem for the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis, and a year later you published another paper with arguments and evidence against it. What do you now make of the two new papers published by the same group in the Journal of Geology?
Well, I have to say I spent some time last night and this morning reading those, and I mostly focused on the areas where my expertise lies, and that is impact physics and the physics of airbursts. And to me, there's really nothing new. In fact, a lot of it just either ignores or misrepresents our criticisms. And so I didn't find them to add much, if anything, to their argument.
Our guest Joanne Ballard told us the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis has been evolving, as you say, and at one point they seemed to suggest a breakup of a space rock then started giant fires on several continents at the same time. Do you think that is possible or likely?
Well, it doesn't really make sense to me, and I and a lot of others have questioned the details of how that could work, how something could break up with just the exquisite timing for all the pieces to hit the Earth, but widely separated enough that they cause fires but do not cause impact craters. There's no impact crater from this event. And so it would have to have broken up just before hitting the Earth, but before it could spread out enough that, you know, only a few of the objects would hit the Earth. And the timing would have to be perfect. And that just, to me, kind of adds to the extremely low probability of what they're suggesting happened.
At least two of the co-authors of these new papers are not scientists, as far as I can tell. One is listed in various places as Dr. Alan West or as geophysicist Alan West, but I can't find support for either of those titles. I asked Alan West for an interview. He declined. Is Alan West's lack of credentials important for assessing the samples that he gathered for some of the earlier research?
Well, I have to say, in science, trust really matters, and reputation really matters. Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify, and that actually was a Russian proverb. And I think I'd kind of turn it around, and I'd say something like, verify before you trust. And I don't have any verified information about Alan West. I know he's been under intense scrutiny, and there was an article by science reporter Rex Dalton a few years ago talking about his role in this. in pointing out that he didn't have any background, or at least there was no evidence for a background. And I haven't seen any background that he's actually got the training or experience to do what he contributes to these papers.
Another co-author of the two new papers is George Howard. According to his online profile, Mr. Howard has a BA in political science from the University of North Carolina. George Howard has a blog called The Cosmic Tusk, and that was recommended to listeners by our guest Joanne Ballard. The Cosmic Tusk blog has a list of articles slamming you, Mark Boslow. How did you develop that special relationship?
Yeah, that's sort of outside the way normal science is done. I mean, we do like to have our vigorous debates at scientific conferences. Usually they don't get personal. I don't try to get bogged down in any kind of personal insult type debate. Some people, I think, find it insulting when you criticize the science, and I think George may be one of those.
Now, Mark Boslow, you have a record of going after anti-science and climate denial. How does this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis get used by climate deniers like Anthony Watt?
Well, I know he's run a few articles about it. I don't know what his position. I don't read his blog, or I rarely look at it.
Really? I'm surprised.
But I know, so Wally Broker, who actually is probably one of the most famous living earth scientists, he's at Columbia University, and he was quoted in that Rex Dalton story saying, you know, this whole controversy with Alan West's background says it does feed the distrust of science. Those who don't believe in human-produced global warming grab onto it. And Wally is actually the guy who coined the term global warming back in his 1975 paper, in which he predicted a lot of what we've now experienced.
I think what the deniers want to do is to say, well, look, these things aren't part of any natural cycle. We can't look at the ice ages and changing climates because, after all, it was just caused by a rock from space, and that's more convenient for them.
Well, I think Wally's right. They tend to grab onto anything, whether there's merit to it or not.
Are you aware of any evidence of a crater showing the impact claimed? And if not, could the crater have escaped our notice, say hidden in the ocean or by landing on a deep ice field like the Laurentide ice sheet?
You know, I looked at that problem. They had suggested a 4-kilometer diameter object hitting the Laurentide ice sheet. And, you know, if it were that big, it would have punched right through and made a big hole in a bedrock. And there's nothing like that. If it was a 4-kilometer diameter object that broke up into a bunch of pieces, well, it's extremely unlikely that they'd all hit the Laurentide ice sheet. And a crater that young and that big, that recent, it wouldn't have subducted. There would be very little erosion. I mean, it would literally still be steaming. The tiny little meteor crater, Arizona, is 50,000 years old, not just 12,000, but, you know, something like a factor of 4 older, and it looks fresh. It looks brand new, and it's tiny. I mean, it's many orders of magnitude smaller than what they're suggesting here. And likewise, there's an impact structure. It's buried, and it took a while to be discovered after the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary event was first proposed in 1980. But it's huge. It's a monster, and it's something like 500 times older, if I did that right in my head that fast. It's 65 million years old, 66 million years old.
You know, the media loves stories of comets and asteroids striking the Earth and causing havoc. Do you think that fascination helps keep this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis going?
I do. I mean, there's a natural human fascination, and that's good. I mean, anything that keeps people interested in science and in the sky and in astronomy, in my opinion, is a good thing. But I think both, you know, your profession in journalism and my profession in science, we have to keep everything a little bit reined in and grounded. And in fact, that is one of the things I do as chair of the Asteroid Day expert panel. So we formed this organization called Asteroid Day. And part of that part of the purpose of this panel we set up is to get experts to make sure that everything we say, everything that goes out is from Asteroid Day, the organization has a press release or as an answer to someone's question, is scientifically correct and defensible. So I think that's really important. And a lot of what we find ourselves doing is chasing down some of these clickbait stories about the next asteroid that's going to destroy the Earth. And those seem to appear with regular frequency.
Yeah, the planet Nibiru, I think it is going to come and get us. Well, it was going to come and get us, and then the dates come and pass. You know?
I think that one may have come and gone.
Yeah. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Boslow, an expert in planetary defense against objects from outer space. And that's the next thing I want to talk to you about, Mark. Are the big institutions like NASA or the EU space program, can they reliably warn us if something from outer space is going to hit us?
Well, I think anything really big, we would have advance warning. Maybe not as much as we would like. I mean, the problem is really big things that would be big enough to take out an entire continent, say, we would have to employ some kind of planetary defense scheme and actually deflect it. I mean, that would be what everyone would hope. But that is going to take something like a decade of lead time. And we don't have a guarantee with our current resources that we would find something with that much time. The smaller ones, the Tunguska-sized or meteor crater-sized events, there's a really good chance we wouldn't see those at all. They may be coming on an orbit. They may be in an orbit that would bring them in from the direction of the sun, and we wouldn't see them at all. We would get zero warning, just like the Chelyabinsk event of February 2013.
Well, it used to be that humans were not very concentrated. They were spread all over the place. But now we have mega cities. I think that increases the chance that one of these things could strike in a heavily populated area.
Well, and it did, and Chelyabinsk did do that. Fortunately, it was only roughly 20 meters in diameter. It was about a half a megaton explosion, and it was 40 kilometers to the south of the city where that energy, you know, was transferred to the atmosphere, creating this big explosion. But it came in at a shallow angle, which spread its energy out over a larger area, so more people experienced it, but the shockwave was actually less intense. And nobody was killed. And that could happen again. But we estimate that an event of that size happens somewhere on Earth roughly once every 50 years. The next one could hit a city. Again, the probability of that is low. I mean, people are concentrated. But cities, you know, if you look at the map of the Earth, cities don't cover that much of a percentage of the Earth's surface.
And it could always just hit the ocean anyway.
Could hit the ocean. Yep, and there's also we also have a concern of tsunami, airburst-generated tsunami, and I've worked with tsunami modelers to try to estimate how bad that would be. Right now, I don't think we've come to a full consensus. There are a lot of people that I think have come to dismiss that idea. I'm not so sure it should be dismissed yet. I think there's still work to be done.
On a personal note, Mark, you turned a private property fight with off-roaders in Colorado into an important new argument, I think, in climate, and that is, talk to us about the right to radiate.
Okay, well, I did blog about that, and it's an idea I've had for some time, and really, it's kind of a libertarian argument, and I know it's funny because a lot of the people who reject the science of climate change don't reject it on the basis of science, they reject it on the basis of what they want to believe. And I think a lot of libertarians or, you know, more conservative people with libertarian ideas, their values want to reject it because it would require some kind of government intervention, and they tend to be sort of against government regulations. So my idea is to kind of get around that libertarian resistance by saying, geez, you know, we have private property rights. And the way we actually cool ourselves, whether it's our private property or the Earth, is we radiate heat into space. It goes up into space, and some fraction of it just keeps going and disappears, and that keeps us cooled off like a cooling fin. But greenhouse gas pollution gets in the way. It absorbs that radiation, and it actually turns around and radiates it back at us. But we've established an easement. An easement is a right-of-way, and that's part of private property rights. So my argument is, well, you could sue the polluter for taking away your private property rights. And in the United States, that's a constitutional right. The Fifth Amendment says you cannot take private property for public use without due process. And there's been no due process in that. So it's kind of a constitutional argument that I think would appeal to libertarians if they thought it through.
And what are you working on these days, Mark?
Well, mostly proposals. I retired in June. I've been very busy. A lot of what I've been doing is public speaking and writing, spending time with my family. But I did spend the entire week last week writing a couple proposals for modeling airbursts on Mars and on Jupiter. And I hope at least one of those gets funded, because I'd like to work on this problem again, but more from a planetary science perspective and maybe a little bit less from a risk perspective, planetary defense perspective.
Why would it matter if there's an airburst on Mars?
Oh, there is a mission to Mars that's going to be launched, hopefully, in May, if everything goes right, the InSight mission, and it's going to have a seismic detector, a seismometer on it, that would detect impacts and airbursts. And so I'm very interested in the way airbursts couple to seismic waves and actually couple through the air as very low frequency infrasound that might be detected by this instrument. And if we can model this correctly, and if everything is successful, we can get an estimate of the impact flux, how many of these small objects are out there hitting Mars.
I think that's a cool place to leave it. We've been talking with physicist Mark Boslow. He's a technical advisor. He was a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories before retiring. And he's an advocate for planetary defense, as you've heard. You can find more links and more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With our ability to find events from many millions of years ago, it should be easy to say whether a comet hit the Earth just before humans developed agriculture and civilization. As you have heard, it is not easy, and scientists do not agree on the results. I spend a lot of time trying to resolve the truth about the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis. I did not succeed, but I did find lots of worthwhile things to explore, some things not raised by either of our guests, so here you go from just a few of my notes. First, as Mark Boslow says, trust is everything in science. I checked out our guest Joanne Ballard. She went through the right training with very good advisors at the master's and doctorate level. Those advisors specialized in subjects helpful to the two new papers. Joanne is a genuine scientist. There's a long history and deep cultural fabric running below this whole topic, and sometimes it interferes. Humans have held a mythology or even religious belief that matter from space drives major events on Earth. Science agrees with a big asteroid ending the age of dinosaurs, hitting near Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago. The whole subject was popularized by a best-selling book published in 1950, which I read in the 1960s, Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. Then in 1979, the Scottish astronomer and author William M. Napier published with Victor Klube A Theory of Terrestrial Catastrophism. Bill Napier is a co-author in the current paper and provided some of the answers relating to astrophysics relayed to us by Joanne Ballard. Richard Firestone and Alan West joined the fray with her 2006 book, The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. The science in that book has since been discounted. As you heard in our interviews, newer papers evolved in their theory of what happened. There is a group of people, mostly scientists, who are dedicated to proving comets continue to make big changes much more recently. They gather in two organizations, the Comet Research Group in the West and the Holocene Impact Working Group, which is based in Russia. Joanne Ballard and the other 29 authors of the new papers in the Journal of Geology belong to the Comet Research Group. The Comet Research Group was founded, well, co-founded, by Dr. Ted Bunch, who is a credible scientist, by George Howard, an enthusiast with no training in the field, and the enigmatic Dr. Alan West. Nobody, including science journalist Rex Dalton, has managed to find any proof of science degrees for Alan West, who took up that name only recently. I don't have a problem with citizen scientists and enthusiasts contributing good ideas and work, but we need honesty about that. By the way, I randomly checked three members listed on the website of the Comet Research Group. Dr. Sylvia Gonzalez replied she is a member, having seen evidence of a major event in her work in Mexico. Another said he is not a member per se, but has written two papers supporting the hypothesis. A third denied any connection to the group. During the interview, Mark Boslow mentioned a critical article by Rex Dalton. It's called Comet Theory Comes Crashing to Earth. It was published May 14, 2011. You can Google it or find a link in my show blog. We also mentioned the paper The Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, A Requiem, with lead author Nicholas Pinter. It was published June 20, 2011 in the journal Earth Science Reviews. The two new papers in the Journal of Geology, as I say, have about 29 authors. In my opinion, that's part of a growing disease in modern scientific literature. Science journals complain too many names are being given to add weight to a publication. There's a committee looking into that, and the abuses of adding names just to help careers with no indication of who did what work. I'm not saying that happened with these two papers in the Journal of Geology, but we have to recognize that a long list of co-authors no longer guarantees anything about whether the science is correct. I was surprised when two of the co-authors here were not scientists at all. The Comet Research Group is like a club of people with common interests in near-term impacts and coming impacts. Their Facebook page is a lively place to check out new arrivals from outer space and research into past contacts. Everything posted there seems to support the Younger Dryas impact theory with no criticism, but I found this Facebook page useful. And I'll be back. You can find a link to it in my show blog. The Comet Research Group is also a nonprofit in the United States. The main poster on their website is George Howard, a blogger at the Cosmic Tusk, the blogger at the Cosmic Tusk. The group is doing fundraising. They hope to get up to $100,000 or more to fund three expeditions to verify their impact theory. Over the past 3 months, they report getting around $35,000. For example, they would like to send members to find an impact crater, perhaps in Greenland or North Dakota. More worrying to me, the Comet Research Group is also sending out an expedition to Jordan to investigate whether a comet destroyed the biblical cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. It sounds like a marriage of mythology and religion, where comets determine human history. Of course, that is possible, but I worry about a cult-like following developing around this subject. Along those lines, the prolific author and amateur archaeologist Graham Hancock has endorsed the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Hancock claims there are many previous civilizations that were wiped out. This impact hypothesis, he says, explains what happened to them. His 2015 book, Magicians of the Gods, is based on the hypothesis. He gives credit to Kennett, Bunch, Alan West, and the gang. Graham has a page promoting the Comet Research Group on his popular website. Hanging around the fringes of the Comet Research Group are commenters who claim the pyramids and Stonehenge are all part of the human response to comet strikes. The scientists can't be blamed for such off-base comments. It's just part of the internet today. George Howard and his blog, The Cosmic Tusk, gets rave reviews from the world's worst climate denial blog, What's Up With That? Anthony Watts has run at least three pieces on the Younger Dryas impact event, and why not? It wasn't really climate change. A space rock did it. To be fair, Watts also reported on studies that refuted the hypothesis. As recently as February 2, 2018, Watts revived the story of massive fires and the comet strike during the time of early humans. So there is a continuing traffic between some supporters of this theory and climate change denial, but there is no climate denial in the scientific papers we're considering in this show. There is another small collection of scientists working on this comet theory. The Holocene Impact Working Group has six scientists who, quote, hypothesize that meteorite impacts on Earth are more common than according to current scientific consensus, end quote. Although the scientists involved come from all over the world, the group server is hosted in Novosibirsk, Russia, by the Tsunami Laboratory Institute, and that's part of the Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences. That lab also maintains an expert database on Earth impact structures. Naturally, since global interest in the strike in Siberia in 1908, the largest in recent times, a cottage industry of scientists and tourists are fascinated by comets in Russia. Again, at the Holocene impact site, we find some books that cover alternative history. One example is Irishman Mike Bailey's 1999 book, Exodus to Arthur, Catastrophic Encounters with Comets. But I also note a Canadian book, Tsunami, the Underrated Hazard, by E. Bryant. Remember, our space expert Mark Boslow said that a tsunami arising from a comet landing in the ocean may be possible. More research is needed, but that could be a big surprise indeed. So where do we end up, and does it matter? I say all the issues around recognizing and measuring comet impacts matter a lot. The energy released from such events is measured in terms of comparable numbers of nuclear weapons exploded. Larger rocks from outer space have already changed Earth's climate and caused mass extinctions. Even the smaller ones can do significant damage, as Mark Boslow told us. Space rocks have passed close to Earth in the last few weeks. A big asteroid is expected to come very close to Earth in 2029. As Boslow said, if smaller ones come from the direction of the sun, we will not even see them before impact. So more science and raising awareness among the public is a positive thing. That's why I did this radio program. It is strange that we can have certainty about an event 66 million years ago, but no certain closure about a strike supposedly 12,800 years ago. NASA still reports the near-Earth object community of planetary scientists say that no large impacts have occurred during the past 15,000 years. As Nicholas Pinter points out, not a single human has been proven killed by a rock arriving from outer space. Statistically, it has been quiet on that front during our human times, but how long can that last? I've got a link to a paper about that in my show blog. So we need artists and even scientists to exercise imagination so our knowledge can progress. But we also have to be very cautious about what is science and what is myth-making. One of the pillars and promoters of the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis is a leading light of science. Dr. James Kennett from the University of California, Santa Barbara, is legendary for his work. Still, as we have seen in the case of Dr. James Lovelock, scientists with vision can sometimes be very right about one thing and still wrong about another, and they may have the same passion for both. We are always going to be challenged about what is good science, and how do we keep our imaginative minds tracking with reality. Check out my weekly show blog for all the links and a new push to expand the reach of this show and its urgent message. That's at ecoshock.org. Thank you for taking this journey with me this week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
They may be misguided. Somebody